Welcome, everyone. This is a special Ma Dang podcast. I am the host of the podcast, which is hosted actually by Christian Century. So Christian Century is somewhere here. Oh, okay, way at the back. So if you're interested, you can get more information. They have a booth down the hall, not down the hall, but down the road. So when you registered, everyone got a copy of the Christian Century magazine. So they're sponsoring Wild Goose, and they host my podcast. So you can go to the Christian Century website and just Google Ma Dang podcast, and you will find all the other episodes. I think there's about 29. I only do one a month. I can barely do one a month. So this is going to be recorded for my podcast, and it will be shared in August. So I think we're in July now, so it'll be shared in August. So thank you so much for coming. Everyone can hear me well? Okay. So there won't be any Q&A, but after the recording, if you had some questions, then you can come up and ask Bill McKibben.
But you have to introduce yourself, too.
Oh, okay, okay. I'll introduce myself. I teach at Earlham School of Religion. I teach theology, and I've written many books, so they are right across the hallway. So you can get some, and I have a few copies of books that they didn't order for some reason. So if you want some, I have some here. And I have flyers from my school. They usually sponsor Wild Goose, but they didn't this year. So they told me to bring some info, so I have some info here. I've hosted Ma Dang for about 2 years. I've had many guests that are here too. Diana Butler-Bass, Brian McLaren, many other ones that are also speaking here or have spoken here in the past. So it's really exciting to do this because I'm a child of an immigrant from Korea. And, you know, I couldn't even speak English, let alone do like a speaking thing in front of the class before I melted away. So I just woke up one day and I said, I'm going to do a podcast. And here I am doing a podcast. Thank you. And I never thought I'll be a preacher, but I am. Are there any? So Earlham is a Quaker school. Any Quakers? I don't think there's any Quakers here, right? Okay, you can be a half Quaker. Oh, we have another full Quaker back there.
One and a half Quakers.
One and a half Quaker. No other Quakers? Quaker what?
Educator.
Oh, Quaker. Okay, that's the best. Yeah, Quaker educated. But I'm actually ordained Presbyterian Church, PCUSA. So any PCUSA? Oh, yeah. We are everywhere, but in our churches. Our churches are so small, but we are still around. We are not extinct. So I never thought I'll be a preacher, but I am a preacher, and I'm doing the Waking Up the Goose tomorrow. 8:30. So please, someone wake me up in the morning, and then I'll be here, and you can all be here at 8:30. I think here, right here in the living room. So it's so exciting to do the podcast because most, all of them have been just via Zoom. Actually, I did one. Reggie Williams is around here somewhere, and I recorded him at the Southern Lights conference. People, I know some of you have been at the Southern Lights, right? Anyone? Yeah, because you approached me and said you heard me at the Southern Lights. So anyway, I did his Ma Dang recording there, and then this is the first time doing the Ma Dang recording here at Wild Goose, and I'm really excited to do it. And I'm so glad to do Bill McKibben. He does not remember, and I don't expect him to, but I did meet him, I don't know, about 10 years ago in New York City. I do a lot of climate change work with the World Council of Churches, and we were having our big rally meeting. There was something going on with the UN at that time, so I was there, and of course, Bill McKibben was speaking, but it was like one of those two-second meetings, and of course, for me, it was very impactful because I admire him so much, and so it's such an honor to have you here on Ma Dang podcast.
What a pleasure to get to join you. Absolutely.
Thank you so much. And for those who are already here the hour before, he gave a whole talk. So I feel so bad that he has to now talk with me for another hour. So I'm just grateful that you are here with me. So thank you so much. So I'll just introduce Bill McKibben. Many of you already know him and have read many of his books. For Madang podcast, majority of my guests are all authors, and I pick one of their recent books to discuss. So to introduce Bill McKibben, he's an educator, environmental activist, and author of more than a dozen books. He is a contributing writer to The New Yorker and a founder of Third Act, which organizes people over the age of 60 to work on climate and racial justice. He founded the first global grassroots climate campaign, 350.org, and serves as a Schumann Distinguished Professor in residence at Middlebury College in Vermont. In 2014, he was awarded the Right Livelihood Prize, sometimes called the Alternate Nobel Prize, in the Swedish Parliament. He's also won the Gandhi Peace Award and honorary degrees from 19 colleges and universities. That's quite amazing, because I don't have any. It's always soon. Been my dream to get one.
Soon.
Oh, I don't know. So today, I'm so delighted to have you on Madang Podcast to share your latest book, The Flag, the Cross, and the Station Wagon. A graying American looks back at his suburban boyhood and wonders what the hell happened. First Things wrote, "We do inhabit the same world, after all, and to see it for a while through Bill McKibben's eyes is good medicine." So welcome to Madang, and thank you so much for coming.
It's a real pleasure to get to join you, and of course, it's wonderful to be doing anything with the Century, which I've read with great affection for a long time. The honest truth is, I actually sent this book off to, when it was in manuscript, off to the Century and said, you can have it if you want to publish an excerpt from. And I think they figured out that I was just a Sunday school teacher, not really a theologian. So they said no, and we excerpted it in The New Yorker instead. So not the end of the world, but it was, but I'm glad now to get to make a belated appearance at the Century.
You know what, before we came on, last year one of my guests was Will Gaffney, and they actually ran a whole article on that episode and put her on the cover of Christian Century. You may have received that issue. So I think they should put a cover of you, but then add me on it.
Yeah, absolutely.
I haven't been on a cover yet, so maybe they're all sitting back there quietly. But anyway, I wanted to tell them on my way here, but now it's live. But that's great. I read your book, and the title, I don't know if anyone has read the book here. Oh, so some of you have read it. The title is very intriguing. The Flag, the Cross, and the Station Wagon. And I started reading it, and it was not what I expected at all. So tell us how you started, because it's part memoir, it's climate change, it has religion, it has democracy, politics, it has so much stuff, but it has your story kind of weaved in with all this historical data, which was remarkable. So tell us how you began writing this book.
Sure. I've written many books over the years, probably 20 or something, but I've never even been tempted to write a memoir, mostly because my life is not interesting in certain ways, as standard as it's possible to be. Nothing that traumatic ever happened to me except finding out at an early age about climate change and having to, but in this case, it began to occur to me that my absolute averageness was a useful kind of data point. I grew up in the suburbs at the moment when the suburbs were the absolute apotheosis, at their absolute zenith as a kind of American landform. I grew up in such a resolutely middle-class fashion that the street we lived on was literally called Middle Street. You know, we lived in a house that my parents bought in 1969 for $30,000, and it looked like a child's drawing of a suburban tract house, one window on the first floor next to the door and two windows up above it, one where my bedroom was and one where my brother's bedroom was. And that was our house. There was a driveway and one tree in front and a Plymouth in that driveway, and that was us. And so if you want to understand, or I began to really want to understand the story of what had happened in my lifetime, politically, religiously, and in material terms. And because the American suburb was the single most important economic force on planet Earth, it seemed worth trying to really get to the bottom of that. And so it's not really a memoir. In fact, it's not a memoir at all, but it is the story of those 10 years in the 1970s in my life when I was in my adolescence, in my teens. And I think that was the hinge decade that decided what was going to happen in America. And I think because of the importance of America and the suburb in America, it largely ended up determining what happened on planet Earth to the temperature and everything else. So that was why it seemed worthwhile to me to break my rule and write about myself at least a little bit in this book.
As you were talking, I actually wanted to write my own memoir, and no publisher wants it. I actually think my life is so exciting. I don't know if anyone watches K-drama, but anyway, I feel like my life is K-drama, but nobody wants my life story. But anyway, I found it so interesting because you were able to tie it in with, you know, the politics with Reagan, with Jimmy Carter, and, you know, it was so fascinating because it was beyond what I expected. And so when you talk about your house, can you expand on how much it was worth last year, et cetera? Because that's an important part.
It is. So I told you that they bought that house in 1969 for $30,000, which would be roughly $200,000 in today's money. And it was sold, when it was sold most recently last year. Now you can go on, of course, on Zillow and immediately discover what everybody's house sells for everywhere. It sold for $1 million. It was exactly the same house, but that $800,000 increase was just the result of being in the right place at the right time, having enough money to make a down payment in those years, and then just riding this escalator up. And that's important because one of the things I really wanted to write about was race. And, you know, people didn't, for obvious reasons, people didn't have, black people in America for the most part, didn't have $30,000 to move into a suburb in 1969, and so they missed out on that escalator. And that's why, the biggest reason why the wealth gap in America between black and white has gotten larger, not smaller, over the last 50 years. Because everybody else has just been on this rocket ride, you know. And it's really worth kind of bearing that kind of thing in mind. Our generation in particular is the, you know, beneficiary of an extraordinary amount of just chronological good luck for having been in the right place at the right time. We've been richly rewarded. And now, you know, if you're a young married couple like my parents now, you somehow have to come up with $1 million to buy the house, and that's not easy, so.
Yeah, so when I read that and heard about the $800,000 increase, just a couple weeks ago, I went to take my kids to Quebec City. And if you've ever been to Quebec City, they have a really expensive hotel called Frontenac Hotel. And I explained to my kids, so you grew up in this suburban kind of area. I grew up in a small town, London, Ontario, and we lived on 3 Frontenac Road, apartment 603. So that Frontenac is this upscale hotel. The one we lived in was this rundown immigrant kind of cockroach motel kind of apartment. So when you were writing about the disparity between black and white, I thought, yes, Asian Americans were there. The Latinx community was there. The Native American community was there too. So you also talk about reparations. I don't know if you want to say.
I'll just add one coda to that story. Uh-huh. Having paid $1 million for the house, the people who bought it immediately tore it down and erected on the same site a house that's basically a cross between a junior high school and a medium security prison in its, you know, appearance. So things continue to, the suburbs continue to be an odd place. And
yeah, so if you can, I found that quite amazing because that's happening. And you talk about the life of the suburban lifestyle and climate change. So can you share with us that connection?
Sure. The suburb, of course, is basically a function of the automobile. I mean, suburbs arose in the post-war years at exactly the moment that the automobile emerged. We didn't have that many cars in America prior to World War II, but in the 50s and 60s, their number exploded. They became, and so a suburb, literally, the physical layout is designed around the turning radius of automobiles. That's how we know how big to build cul-de-sacs and, you know, on and on. Which means that they became the great engine for pouring carbon into the atmosphere. There have been two huge bursts of carbon. One was the suburbanization of America, and the other was the industrialization of China. And the first is actually bigger than the second in total volume. But its impact was astonishing, world-changing in those ways. And so both these things are debts that have been run up. And the good news is that we have the resources to make good on some of those debts. That's what that $800,000 means, that there's money there to, you know, pay whatever we're going to call it, reparations to people who didn't get to take part in any of that, or to people who get drowned out in Pakistan or whatever else. Some part of that, you know, $800,000 belongs to them because it was built on their backs in that sense. So that's the good news. I mean, it's not as if we're impoverished. We're not. Mm-hmm.
And then in your book, you also talk about, so you were in Lexington, Massachusetts, and they were trying to do the Affordable Housing Act. Can you explain about that? Because that's tied in with the racial justice issues.
I can. Yeah. When I was 10, I wasn't paying attention at the time. Two things happened. Uh-huh. So I'll tell the two stories. One I knew was going on, and that was this remarkable moment when this was at the height of the Vietnam War, and the Vietnam Veterans Against the War decided that they wanted to come and hold a protest on Lexington Green, the birthplace of American liberty, led by a young, handsome John Kerry, recently returned lieutenant from Vietnam. And the town father said, no, you can't. We'll arrest you if you do. And so 500 people from the town showed up to get arrested alongside them, including my father, who was very unlike him. He was a quite mild-mannered business reporter, but he felt strongly about the war, in part because of his church. And so, you know, he spent the night at the DPW garage, and it obviously made a big impression on me. And the impression it made on me was, in some intuitive way, the sense that this was a good sign, that we were more or less in this country on the right path, that we were standing up to war and standing up for peace, and that things were going to get better, and this sort of project of the kind of group project of building a better America was clearly continued to be underway, the one that had begun during the Depression and, you know, came with the Civil Rights Act and on and on and on. So that was my, I think, my intuitive takeaway from that. It turns out that 6 weeks later than that, Lexington voted on an affordable housing project, the first in the town. Lexington had, it was a liberal town, and Dr. King had come for a visit in 1963 or 64, and everybody in town turned out at the high school to hear him, and he was, and in the wake, they formed something with the wonderful name of the Suburban Responsibility Commission. And they decided their responsibility was to make sure that Lexington was integrated more. It wasn't segregated by law. It was just segregated by the fact that it was too expensive. And so the reason that suburbs are expensive to live in is because you have a house with a lawn and a driveway, and if everybody has to have one of those, then it's expensive. And the antidote to that is apartments, what we call now multifamily housing of one kind or another. So the Suburban Responsibility Commission decided that we would have an affordable housing development in Lexington. And all the town fathers got behind it, and every preacher in town preached in favor of it, and it actually passed town meeting. Lexington has, New England has a town meeting, so it's a representative town meeting, but 200 of the townspeople voted, yes, we'll do it. But then someone collected enough petitions to demand that there be a referendum vote on this. And in the privacy of the voting booth, Lexingtonians voted 2-1 against having affordable housing in the town. Not, I think, so much out of race prejudice, but out of a deep attachment to property values and the sense that they might begin to erode things. And to me, those two events were kind of markers of the two possibilities. One, this America is a group project, let's make it a better place. And the other, America is a series of individual market decisions, let's look out for our own selves, you know? And I think the 1970s were the crucible decade in which these two ideas kind of fought it out, and by the end, the verdict was very clear. In 1978, California passed Proposition 13, which basically did away with the notion that suburbanites were gonna pay serious taxes in order to spread the wealth in any way, like by having good schools and stuff. And then in 1980, we elected Ronald Reagan, who was the his entire reason for being was the idea that we should not do things together. Government is the problem, not the solution. You know, his ideological soulmate, Margaret Thatcher, literally said, there is no such thing as society. There are only individual men and women, which is seems to me deeply un-Christian, and B, seems to me to have, we now know that wasn't a good idea just in pragmatic terms either. Mm-hmm. It produced markets left to their own devices, have produced cartoonish levels of inequality, and we've managed to melt the North Pole. So those are bad signs about what happens when you just let markets decide everything and everybody just works as hard as they can to get rich themselves. Those are the things that result.
Yeah. Thank you for explaining that. And then just along what you're saying, you also talk about, you see, I've always used the word individualism. Western society is very individualistic. I forgot to mention I was born in Korea, and then we immigrated to Canada, and then I moved to the US in 2004 to start teaching. Just recently, I took some students to Korea. So one thing you will know about Korea, Korean society is we love to eat, okay? So when we meet one another, we always ask, have you eaten? And if they say yes, and I say I haven't, we have to go and eat. But eating is a very kind of communal act. People don't like to go and eat by themselves. It's very different from Western society where we just, you know, we'll just eat at our desk or eat by ourselves at a restaurant. It's no big deal. But you'll rarely see that. So if you're a stay-at-home mom and it's dinner time and your kid's home late and you're hungry, you will wait till the kid comes home because you don't want to eat by yourself. So it's this kind of communal society, which, you know, I was born there. I still have so much of that within me. But you talk about hyper individualism. So can you explain that?
Sure. I mean, look, America's clearly always has been an individualist society. And there are good things about that. There are benefits and weaknesses to every approach to things. And there have been strong things about the sort of strong American individualist ethos. But as with anything taken to extremes, it becomes, I suppose you could imagine a kind of hyper-communal society where things were, you know,
always,
where you lacked all privacy and had no, you know, and that. But hyper-individualism, I think, is a good description for what happened in the kind of Reagan era and since. The exaltation of the individual, to the degree that we consider it deeply offensive to tax or regulate or, you know, any of those things, that doctrine was really, really powerful. And it's, I think, a fairly new development in human history. And a development, among other things, dependent on the fact that we happen to be living in this super easy time. You know, we've lived through the period when, in the last 50 years, neighbors have essentially been optional in America. Like, you didn't really need them for anything. If you have a credit card, someone will deliver everything you need to survive to your doorstep. You'd never actually have to meet anybody. Well, neighbors are not going to be optional for the next 50 years. Like right now, today in Vermont, after our flooding, neighbors are not optional. I mean, you need people to help dig the mud out of your basement and get your road going. That's going to change. But that hyper-individualism set us up for where we are. And one of the reasons that we know it's not a good idea is not just that the poles melted and not just that we ended up with individual Americans who have more money than the bottom half of the population combined. It's also that it turns out not to make us all that happy. We're not actually, we're socially evolved primates. It was not that long ago that we were all happily sitting on the savanna picking lice out of each other's fur, you know? We're not designed to be by ourselves all the time and to rely entirely on ourselves. And so, one of the most remarkable data sets in America is this set where they ask people whether or not they're happy with their lives. A question that they started asking after World War II and have asked faithfully every year since. And the percentage of Americans who describe themselves as very happy peaks sometime in the late 1950s and goes downhill since, even though our, you know, stock of stuff just kept going up and up and up. It's an experiment. Does having endless amount of stuff make you endlessly happy? Turns out not. In fact, it probably has the opposite effect because it tends to deprive you of that human contact. If you think about a suburb, I mean, if you think about what we did with our money, our enormous prosperity in the decades that followed World War II, the greatest burst of prosperity any society has ever seen or will ever see. We spent most of that, the great bulk of that, on the project of building bigger houses farther apart from each other. And the result of that is that you have to, you don't run into people in the same numbers. The average American has half as many close friends as the average American of the 1950s. That's a big change for a socially evolved primate. It's no wonder that we kind of, you know, less than, you know, ecstatic at all times, because we're kind of lonely.
So that's kind of remarkable, you know, reading all that material and trying to digest everything. And then tied in with that, you talk about, when you get to the cross section, about the history of Christianity. So me as a theologian, you know, that's so important to me. But I really realized reading your book that this is all intersectional. I actually co-wrote a book called Intersectional Theology, that everything is intersectional, you know, environmental racism, gender justice, racial justice, economic justice. You know, these are all intersectional, and I really got that from your book. So talking about this, you know, this wealth creation and then this racial injustice with the black community, reparations, and then history of Christianity. I don't know if you want to say something about what happened to the denominations.
Sure. Yeah. Because it's an important part of the story. I mean, one of the things that happened was that we went from a world that was heavily mainline Protestant to a world where that was a much rarer, an exceptional thing to be. And did it in very short order. In 1960, 52% of Americans belonged to one of the mainline denominations, and now that number is 13%, and most of that had happened by 1990, you know, so a sort of 30-year period. Just, I mean, that was the biggest demographic shift in a lot of ways in my lifetime. And I think that it mirrors this process that we've been describing. Because for all their weaknesses and defects and hypocrisies and all the things we can always point to, those churches were embedded in this world of the group project of America, making America a better place. And the evangelical churches that replaced them were very embedded in this project of individual, in this case, individual salvation, individual prosperity. And that's a, those shifts are too congruent to be coincidental. They're clearly connected in some way. And I think that that's had big, big effects running both directions on our political and our spiritual lives over that period.
I think your observation is so helpful. And I'm wondering, is that all tied in with the growth of Christian nationalism too? I don't think you really touched it in the book, but I was just curious as you were speaking about it.
I've been trying to do some writing about this rise of Christian nationalism, because it's very tied in. If you ask a very almost perfect predictor of whether or not someone will identify as a Christian nationalist on a series of, is if you ask people, is the fact that that there's this huge wealth gap between black and white in this country, is that a reflection of racial discrimination, or is it a reflection of the fact that black people don't work as hard? And you can predict with stunning accuracy you know, what people are going to think about on a bunch of other issues. And one of the really sad things is you can predict how people are going to answer that question by how much time they spend in church. And the more time they spend in church, the more likely they are to answer it in the hideous way that denies American history. So that's the, you know, that's a powerful indictment, I think, of the evangelical idea. But it makes complete sense, because if your entire theological focus is on the individual, your own salvation, your own prosperity, why wouldn't that also be your entire political focus? It has to be a result of your individual effort that you ended up in whatever predicament you've ended up in. And, you know, I mean, the fact that it's completely anti-biblical is, you know, beside the point in this equation.
I wish we had this conversation. I just submitted a book. I called it Whiteness to InterVarsity Press, and then you know how they all change. I don't know. Was this the title of your book originally?
Yeah.
It was. Yeah. Oh, okay. Because most cases they change your title, and they changed it to, drum roll. Oh, thank you. So they changed it to When God Became White. I was shocked that they changed it to that because it was mostly on whiteness, but then they changed it. So now I actually like the title.
I think it's a pretty good title. Yeah,
I
like it.
Isn't it good now? Yeah, I fought with them a bit, and then now I really like it. But I like it, but I think what you're saying is so true. It's all connected together, and what the denominations were losing them, and the evangelical movement, and then the Christian nationalism. And really, you know, that's tied in with this whiteness and, you know, who God is this white God, etc., which is very, very problematic. So I wish I had this conversation because now I'm really almost done with that book. But you talk also a lot about spiritual formation and how you like the book of Job. Mm-hmm. For me, I've never really liked that book, but yeah, I know. So I was like, so
you're
excited.
You're not alone. You're not alone. I mean, okay.
I don't really like the Old Testament to begin with, but I have a problem with everything anyway.
Well, the reason, actually, what's interesting about the, you know, the rabbis really sort of ignored Job for a very long time, but it's because it wasn't particularly the Old Testament. If you think about it, it's really the first modern story. Because it has a very ambivalent, I mean, the whole plot of the story is, you know, of course, Job has, all these bad things are happening to him, but why? And so for 37 quite repetitious chapters, his quite boring friends keep insisting that it's because he sinned. He'd done something wrong, or his kids had done something wrong, or probably his wife had done something wrong, and so he was being punished, because this was the physics of the Old Testament in a lot of ways, right? And so what's revolutionary about the book is that Job, not at all the patient Job of legend, just keeps saying, yeah, you know what, I actually was not that bad a guy. You know, whatever I did, it definitely was not, I mean, this is, you know, this punishment is outsized. I demand that God come and give an explanation. His friends are like, you don't want to go there. And Job's like, no, I demand, you know, and be careful what you wish for, because God appears speaking from a tornado, which is pretty upsetting to begin with. And then delivers, you're the theologian here, not me, but I believe the longest speech that God gives any place in the Bible, Old Testament or New. There's somebody here who will know the answer to that question, but I'm going to say it confidently. But it's a very modern answer to the story, because God doesn't give any kind of rational explanation at all. He just gives this tour of the universe, and it's incredibly beautiful. It's the first great piece of nature writing in the Western canon. Read it in Stephen Mitchell's translation, North Point Press translation. It's fantastic, and it's beautiful. You know, it's introduced all the animals, and the ostrich is so stupid that it keeps, you know, stepping on its own kids, but it's redeemed by its pure speed, you know, and the vultures are all off hunting carrion for their young, and some of it's just heartbreaking. The gazelle gives birth, and then its young go away, and mother never sees them again, you know. There's just sort of this beautiful heart. It's also incredibly weird, because God is in a highly sarcastic mood. And the whole thing is like, Job, you know, why are you bothering me? Like, if you're so smart, you tell me, where do I keep the storms? Can you call up a blizzard? Do you tell the proud waves where to break, whatever? And Job is just like, no, you know, sorry I asked. And that was, I mean, so the answer is this very kind of, that's why I think the rabbis didn't sort of set it aside, because it didn't fit into any of the kind of narratives that people were working with exactly. But it fits into the moment, the narrative of this moment, all too well, because, you know, if God says to us, do you tell the proud waves, here you shall break and no further? We're like, oh yeah, that's us. You know, we're gonna raise the level of the ocean 5 feet in the next 50 years, just us. We God says that we don't have to sit down and apologize. We just spit right in his eye, you know? And so it for our purposes, it's incredibly powerful text. And like a lot of things, I think, in the Bible, I think there's lots of buried treasure there that's appropriate for the moment in which you happen to come across it. And the lesson, if the lesson for Job was, you're a small part of a big, beautiful, buzzing, weird, cruel, mysterious creation, that's got to be enough for you. Don't worry about justice in quite the ways you have been, you know. If that was the message for Job, the message for us is, get smaller fast, you know. You're too big. So that's, I mean, for me, that was the single most powerful encounter with the Bible in my life, I think.
Wow. I have to go back and read the book of Job. I think we all need to go back and read the book of Job. Also, you included a statistics that in the 1970s, when people were asked if they believed in God, it was 97%. And then now that has dropped to 47%. Why is there that big drop? Because I would think that, yeah, they don't go to church, but somehow they may still believe. Yeah.
Well, we've been told to that we're the measure of all things. I mean, that's what individual, why would you need, you know, if you're the, I mean, what is a consumer society? What is its basic message? Its basic message is, you are the heaviest object in the known universe. All things must orbit around you. This buds for you, you know? I mean, think about the world in which we live. You have in your pocket a device to make sure that you, you know, it's like a, you know, the functional equivalent of a court jester for a king in the Middle Ages that is there to amuse and entertain you 24/7 with everything you want. If you want dancing girls, it will provide dancing girls. If you want, you know, to watch baseball, it'll do that. It'll entertain you with every, you have access to every musical, vaguely musical sound ever recorded in the last, you know, 100 years at your fingertips. What purpose does God have in this universe, you know?
Yeah.
If your own efforts are the only thing that, and the only thing you're supposed to care about is yourself, God is somewhat superfluous to all of this.
Thank you so much for sharing that. Because we're running out of time, I wanted to ask you about how you started 350.org. Did I say it right?
Yes.
Yeah. And for those who are over 60, I'm not there yet, but I'll be there soon.
That's the good thing about Third Act. Everybody is headed our way, you know.
So if you can explain,
if you're
about
lucky,
the Third Act.
I mean,
yeah, that's true, yeah. I hope to get past 60, yeah. I always worry about, I think about death all the time. Every day I'm thinking about death. So explain to us, because so many of us are concerned about this climate crisis, and it is all intersecting with the gender justice, racial justice, etc. But some of us don't know what to do.
Well, this goes straight to this discussion we've been having about individualism. Mm-hmm. The American default is to say, what can I do to deal with this? And so the answer is, buy a Tesla, you know, whatever. That's good, but we've long since been past the point where we could make the math work, you know, one vegan dinner at a time. So the actual way to address this question is, what can we do? And that we is this hearkening back to this 20th century idea that we were going to engage in a project to make things better. In this case, we need a movement to counter the extraordinary financial power of the fossil fuel industry, which is the power and principality of the age in which we live. And so there's no way that we're going to raise enough money to do that. Exxon has, I mean, again, I'm no theologian, but Exxon has more money than God, I believe. So no way we're going to raise enough money. We're going to have to use the other currency, the currency of movements, which was a currency minted in the 20th century. It was minted by Gandhi, by the suffragettes, by Dr. King, by Ella Baker, by Rosa Parks, by Fannie Lou Hamer, by James Lawson, by the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, by a million people whose names we don't know, but who figured out this sort of strange alchemy of movement building, especially with nonviolent action that allows the small and the many to stand up to the mighty and the few. So that's why we started organizing 350.org, which became the first iteration of a global grassroots climate movement. We've organized 20,000 demonstrations in every country on earth except North Korea for reasons that will be obvious to you. And then it's the reason that we started Third Act, because young people who've been doing most of the work here, they need some help. They're providing the leadership, but young people lack the structural power to make change on the scale we need in the time that we have. And old people, like me, have, not only do I have hair coming out my ears, I have structural power coming out my ears like everybody else my age. That's because there's a lot of us, because we all vote. I said yesterday there is no known method for stopping old people from voting. And because we ended up with most of the money. You know, we have 70% of the country's financial assets. So if you want to push around Wall Street or Washington or your state capital, old people are a good thing to have. The conventional wisdom was that old people got more conservative as they age. If that was true at one point, I don't think it's true now, because the people who are in their 60s or 70s or 80s now, when they were in their first act, were around for this period of epic social and cultural and political transformation. We rewrote the way that the world worked. We didn't perhaps keep it up as perfectly as we should have. I said earlier, there's a case to be made that taken as a whole, in our second act, we were somewhat more engaged in consumerism than in citizenship. Okay, but that's, you know, that milk has been spilled, and now we're in our third act, and we've got time, we've got resources in some cases, we've got a lifetime worth of skill, and we have a much stronger sense of legacy. That sounds like a very abstract thing until you're closer to the exit than you are to the entrance, at which point it begins to seem a little more real. Your legacy is the world you leave behind for the people you love the most. And we're going to leave behind a world that's a lot worse than the one that we found unless we get our act together very fast. But we can play a huge role in getting that act together. It has been huge fun to watch tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of older Americans pour in the door to go to work. And interestingly, a large percentage of them were people who had been in those mainline churches back in the pews in the 1960s. They were going to church youth group and vacation Bible school, and there's some even if they didn't spend their whole life in the church, some strong residue of that experience remains. And that, I think that's one of the resources that people are drawing on as they go to work. So it's, you know, no guarantees, but it's good to have some more people fighting. And it's good for the young people who are doing this leading to have the feeling that they have not been abandoned to their fate, because that is really a strongly held feeling by a lot of young people, and a really paralyzing and unfair and sad one. So if for no other reason, it's a great idea to sort of figure out how to back up kids doing good stuff.
Thank you so much, Bill McKibben, for coming on Madang Podcast, sharing your book, The Flag, The Cross, and The Station Wagon. I hope everyone gets a chance to read it. Thank you for your life.
Thank you for excellent, excellent questions. This has really been fun.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Such a pleasure. And thank you all for coming and listening and support 350 Act and the Third Act, and you can support Madang Podcast too. Thank you so much. Yeah. And for those who are interested in Earlham, I have some flyers and I have a few of my books here too if you're interested. Thank you so much.